Welcome to the Real Clear Politics Takeaway for Friday, September 17th. I'm Andrew Walworth. Well, Governor Gavin Newsom prevailed in his quest to retain his office last Tuesday in the California recall election, notching a 30-point victory over the Republican-led effort to remove him from office. Pundits are feasting on the lessons of those results, and we'll talk about what they may mean for the midterms and beyond. In Virginia, another closely watched election is now underway as early voting in that state's gubernatorial contest start today, Friday, although the final results won't be known until November. And listeners of a certain age may remember the party game Twister, where the point was to contort yourself into all sorts of pretzel shapes without actually falling down. Democrats on Capitol Hill are engaged in a very high-stakes version of that game as they try to keep their caucus together to pass both a reconciliation bill that includes big tax hikes, as well as an infrastructure bill that has more popular support. This week, it was the green energy portion of the bill that required some fancy moves to keep the game going, and we'll talk about whether all these gyrations will lead to success or whether it all comes crashing down. Joining me to talk about all this are Tom Bevin, Real Clear Politics co-founder and president, Carl Cannon, Washington Bureau chief, and Sean Trendy, RCP's senior election analyst. So, Tom, Governor Newsom is often criticized as a San Francisco elitist who is out of touch with the common folk of California. Maybe he didn't get the memo on that, but here's how he described his victory on Tuesday. He said, quote, "Democracy is not a football. You don't throw it around. It's more like, I don't know, an antique vase. You can drop it, smash it into a million different pieces, and that's what we're capable of doing if we don't stand up to meet the moment and push back." So other than the fact that he does seem a bit elitist, what did you take away from his victory, which was a sizable margin after all?
It was. I mean, what I take away from his victory is that the perfect storm scenario for Republicans that they had hoped for, right, that Democrats wouldn't pay attention to this election, that they'd be super energized and show up at the ballot and overwhelm Democrats, did not happen. I mean, Gavin Newsom spent $80 million on ads blanketing the state. There was a concerted effort to really shift the focus from Gavin Newsom and his leadership and his record to Larry Elder and frightening people into, you know, hey, this is what it's going to look like if we have a Republican governor. And it did energize Democrats, and they turned out in more than sufficient numbers and outnumbering Republicans 2-1 in the state. I mean, it ended up being pretty much a breeze. But I don't know. I saw a lot of commentary the day before when it seemed pretty clear that Newsom was on his way to victory, from members of the media blob suggesting that this was a referendum on his COVID policies and blue state Democrat COVID policies around the country, and it was going to turn the tide for Democrats against Republicans on the issue of COVID, et cetera, et cetera. I think all that's just ridiculous. I mean, I think this was an election that was unique to California, and the results don't really tell us that much about what's going to happen next November.
Carl, you buy that? I mean, the conventional wisdom coming out of this, it seemed, or at least I read a lot of pieces that were saying two things. One, pro-vaccine policies are popular and the Democrats should run on that and run against governors who are opposing him. And two, that it shows that Trump still is the bogeyman that keeps on giving if you're a Democrat.
Well, Andy, I edited a story about that this week. But the guy who wrote the story is on our panel today. So why don't I defer to Sean Trendy on that? And I'll answer the second part about the Trump bogeyman in a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the flip question is like, what would we say if it had been a 10-point race? Would we still be saying, oh, you can't really extrapolate to the national trends? No, like we would be saying things are shifting against Biden. So, you know, the fact that Newsom won handily, I mean, yeah, you need the context. Larry Elder was a terrible candidate. For California, and it's, you know, deeply blue state. At the end of the day, you know, things shifted like a point or two from where things were in 2020. That's actually enough for Republicans to win the popular vote for Congress, so it's not completely inconsequential. But I wouldn't write this off altogether. On the vaccine thing, look, vaccine mandates are popular, but that doesn't tell the entire story. The problem with that analysis is that the people who, you know, like I like vaccines. I think they're good. I think everyone should get one. I'm not particularly excited about it. You know, like it's something that happens to someone else, and I think it'll save their lives. But boy, if I were an anti-vaxxer and I felt coerced into getting a chemical that I don't want injected into my body, I would be going ballistic right now.
This is saliency, right? We try to educate our viewers or listeners from time to time, but this is an important political science concept.
Yeah, you can have issues that split 90-10, like background checks for guns. But it doesn't even out because that 90% is like, I like background checks, but like they aren't going to vote on it. That 10% will vote on it. And so you have something that might be lopsided in terms of public opinion, but in terms of the energy it generates, it's lopsided the other way. And I think vaccine mandates are probably a similar story.
Andy, this is Carl. I'd say the same thing happened in the California race about that French Laundry appearance of Gavin Newsom. You know, that Fox News couldn't get enough of that story. Conservatives talked about it. And not just elitists in Washington. I mean, people in Orange County, people were mad at Gavin Newsom. Oh, he went to this French Laundry thing. So there was a minority of people, a small group who felt that he was a hypocrite on vaccines and masking and, you know, lockdowns. But most Californians didn't feel that way. And this turned out to be kind of a non-issue in the California race. And Gavin Newsom did something interesting in it. If you know California politics intimately, there was an antecedent for it. And it also involved a former San Francisco mayor, which Gavin Newsom is. His name was George Christopher. And he was challenging Pat Brown, who was Jerry Brown's father. Pat wanted to run for a third term in the mid-60s. And George Christopher was a popular liberal Republican mayor of San Francisco. And the Democrats decided that they were a little worried about George Christopher. So they smeared Christopher. They ran these negative ads against him, dishonest ads, actually, in order to bolster a guy they thought would be easy to beat, an actor from Southern California named Ronald Reagan. Obviously, that backfired him. In this case, the Democrats were handed a much easier task. All they had to do was elevate the Republican, Larry Elder, who'd emerged out of nowhere to be leading the pack. And these attacks on Elder simultaneously scared the bejesus out of Democrats in California and independents, while also elevating Elder. That $80 million didn't only go, as Sean and Tom said, it didn't go to promoting Gavin Newsom's record. It went towards saying, Larry Elder is Donald Trump. And if you wanted Donald Trump, you should want Larry Elder. But that also took all the air out of the balloon for the Republicans. No Republican was ever allowed to emerge other than Larry Elder. So it was a very smart strategy, and it worked. And it worked because Larry Elder isn't a good match for California.
Tom, does it tell us anything about Donald Trump nationally? I mean, they did tie Elder and Trump together. Biden appeared there Monday. He said this. He said, all of you know, in the last year, I got to run against the real Donald Trump. Well, this year, the leading Republican running for governor is the closest thing to a Trump clone that I have ever seen in your state.
You know what's interesting about that? And Carl and I were talking about this the other day. Gavin Newsom, when he was governor, when Trump was president, was actually one of the few blue state governors who treated Trump with respect and said, you know, hey, I'm working with the guy and I may not agree with him, but vastly different than what we saw from the governor of my state, J.B. Pritzker, and, you know, Gretchen Whitmer, and certainly Andrew Cuomo in New York. So that's a little bit ironic, but I don't know if Trump is going to be the bogeyman that, as you said at the intro, that keeps on giving for Democrats. I mean, I think that will only take them so far in terms of their messaging for the midterms. And it may, I mean, we're going to get another test here in just a couple of weeks, because that's been Terry McAuliffe's entire strategy in Virginia, is to paint Glenn Youngkin, who is really not as close to Trump or anything like Trump in terms of his sort of political profile. So we will see, again, get another test of how effective that strategy is. It may get him someplace, especially if we see in the primaries that you have a lot of Trumpy candidates that are winning these primaries. It could be more effective in next November than Republicans would like it to be. But there's a long way to go between now and then.
Oh, Tom talks about Glenn Youngkin. Last night, they had a debate, Glenn Youngkin and Terry McAuliffe. And I don't know how many people in Northern Virginia watched it, because the team formerly known as the Redskins was on television. But Terry said just what Tom said. I think his closing statement, he said Youngkin was an extreme, too extreme, and a Trump wannabe. Youngkin's wasting a lot of time where he'd like to be making his argument, having to defend himself against this. And that's a tough spot for him too, because in order to win, he can't alienate the Virginians who voted for Trump. He needs them all. And then he needs more people besides. So it's I guess what I'm saying, and I think Sean and Tom agree, is that Virginia's maybe a better test of this than California was if we're looking ahead to the midterms.
That's ultimately what this is about. It doesn't matter whether Youngkin is a Trump clone or not. It's about pushing Youngkin into a corner where he has to choose, where he can say, no, I'm not at all like Trump, and alienate half of Western Virginia, or say, yeah, I love Trump, and alienating what he needs in Northern Virginia. So that's ultimately what that tack from McAuliffe is about.
So we're talking about the race in Virginia, and that is between Terry McAuliffe, who very prodigious fundraiser for the Democrats, former head of the DNC. He's running against Glenn Youngkin, who's a political novice, but former CEO of the Carlyle Group, the large private equity firm. He's got an estimated net worth of $300 million. He's putting a lot of his own money into the campaign. Sean, following up on that, you know, McAuliffe is tying him to Trump, but he's also tying him to the anti-vax movement. His first tweet, I think, after the debate last night, which Carl was talking about, said, look, folks, you can't be pro-jobs without being pro-vaccine. Last night made it crystal clear, we cannot afford to put anti-vax Glenn Youngkin in charge. You know, going back to what you were saying before, is that going to work in Virginia? And to Carl's point, Youngkin is not really as Trumpy as, you know, maybe another candidate would be, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, California went for Biden by like 30 points. Virginia went for him by 10. So, you know, and if you take the 4-point swing in California and apply it to Virginia, you're talking about a 6-point race, which is around where the polls have it. I think Youngkin's doing a little bit better than that. So I think the strategy is riskier there. You know, I think especially since you might now notice he didn't say anti-vaccine mandate, though. He's calling him anti-vax, which is a whole nother ballgame. I mean, I'm not crazy about vaccine mandates, but I'm not. I think anti-vaxxers are kind of crazy. And so that's the strategy there. You know, it's a pitch to the Loudoun County. I was going to say Fairfax, but Fairfax is solid blue now. To the Loudoun counties and Prince William counties of the world, that this guy is not just anti-vax, vaccine mandate. Like, he doesn't think you should be getting it at all. Whether that's true or not, I don't
know.
Well,
it's untrue.
Yeah,
it's unfactual. And Glenn Youngkin said last night, reiterated, he's gotten the vaccine. I'm a strong, strong advocate for everyone to get the vaccine. Then adding Sean's point, I do believe individuals should be allowed to make that decision on their own. So he is anti-vax mandate, not anti-vaccine. And Terry's deliberately muddying those waters.
Tom, tell us about the polls. What are you seeing in Virginia?
Well, we had a poll just come out a couple of days ago from Emerson that had this at a 4-point race. We've got a few other polls that are a little less fresh, dating all the way back to the beginning of August, but our average has it at 5 points. And there's Trafalgar Group, which is a Republican polling firm, has it at 1 point, and then it's as high as, I think, 9 points in another poll. So on average, about 5, which is what, you know, Sean had mentioned earlier. I mean, I do think this is potentially pretty close, and I think it's going to require, though, as Virginia does now, in general, for Republicans. I mean, they're going to need huge turnout from all across the state. And that gets to Sean's point about you got to have the Trump vote energized in the western part of the state. I mean, you just can't win without it. But can you do that while also appealing to, and this was Glenn Youngkin's pitch in the primary, right? He was running against Trump in high heels and a couple other folks. He said, look, I'm the only one who can do this, who can bridge that gap. And so we'll see if he's able to do that. And on top of it, you know, he is a political novice. This is his first rodeo. And so it's going to be an interesting needle to thread, and we'll see whether he's able to do it rhetorically and politically or not.
Sean, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean,
you're not allowed to say I don't know on a political podcast.
No, but that is the right answer with Youngkin. You know, he's a newcomer. And so we have no way of evaluating what his political chops really are. You know, and this race has kind of been quiet over the summertime. As a matter of fact, Youngkin was coming under fire for not spending. You know, I think it's, for me, the one thing that stands out in these polls is that Terry McAuliffe, who is a, you know, well-known, universally known former governor of Virginia, is below 50%. You know, he is a de facto incumbent in this race. And anytime you see an incumbent under 50%, it's not great news for that candidate. You know, the fact that Biden is unpopular nationally and is probably close to 50-50 in Virginia, I think does point to this being a very close race. And it will come down to whether Youngkin has political chops or not, I think. And we just don't know that. I never in a million years thought we would be in this position. Terry McAuliffe was a reasonably successful governor of the state, reasonably popular. I thought he was going to come out of the gate leading like 60-40, and maybe Youngkin would close the gap as he became better known. So the fact that we're starting out the hot election portion of the season with it effectively tied is not great news for McAuliffe.
Carl, what do you think?
Yeah, I'll just add to that. You know, the last time we had a situation exactly like this, Democratic incumbent president in his first year in office, and then a open seat. Virginia's governor is always an open seat, but it was Barack Obama carried Virginia in 2008, and then the following year, 2009, a Virginian, Bob McDonnell, Republican, won handily. And it looked like a huge swing in votes. It wasn't that exactly. You had much lower turnout, but the Republicans turned out and the Democrats didn't. So that's Youngkin's playbook if he can follow it.
So Tom, we're going to talk about the reconciliation bill in a minute, but with Biden's polling going south, not a good summer for the administration. If this thing blows up in September, which, like I said, we'll talk about in a second, if that doesn't pass, does this have any implications in a close race in Virginia? I mean, could it be enough if Biden is down further in the polls? Could that drag down Terry McAuliffe? He's pretty much tied to the Democratic Party, right?
Sure. I mean, of course. And it would be not just for this election, but obviously the broader implications are for next November if he can't get his numbers back up. And this is the flip side to, you know, Democrats wanting to nationalize every race around tying people to Donald Trump. And Republicans are going to do the same thing, tying these. I mean, that's the theme now of our elections is it's not so much local anymore. All these races are now nationalized. And so Biden's job approval is going to matter. What happens in Congress over the next 3 weeks is going to matter. You can bet Nancy Pelosi is going to star in a bunch of commercials, as is AOC and Rashida Tlaib and everybody else. And so that's the flip side for Democrats is, you know, because Donald Trump isn't on the ballot. Not, Joe Biden isn't on the ballot either, but they control all three levers of government. They control it all. And even though it's only by a tiny bit and it's giving them fits at the moment in Congress in terms of passing their agenda, you know, Republicans are going to paint that picture that this is what you get when you have total Democratic control and there needs to be a course correction. And in midterms past, including the most recent ones, the electorate has been very receptive to that kind of messaging.
Sean, what do you think?
Yeah, look, elections are referenda on the party in power. I've said that again and again. There is a choice element to it. But at the end of the day, if people like the president, the party does well. And if people don't like the president, the party doesn't do well. And that's true of these local elections. You know, yeah, McDonnell won by, you know, 18 points in 2009, but the state was a lot redder then. You know, it was still a few points to the right of the country as a whole. And today it's, you know, 3 to 4 points to the left. So Republicans start in a bigger hole. And I don't think Terry McAuliffe is Creed Eads. So yeah, the fact that Biden's job approval is in the mid to high 40s is really bad, because especially for the Democrats in the House that are going to be running in these districts that are Trump districts or you know, marginally Trump districts, that means Biden's job approval is probably going to be somewhere around 42-43%. That is a very, very tough lift in our current polarized environment.
Well, Carl, let's talk about the Hill. The Democrats have this reconciliation bill. They've got a self-imposed deadline of September 27th to get a vote on it. This week, they turned the climate change aspect of the bill. That was a big part of the Biden presidential campaign, was promising to do something about climate change. It's important to the progressive wings of the Democratic Party. It's also important to Joe Manchin, who happens to be from West Virginia, which is a coal state. What's going on here? And is this the thing that possibly sinks the effort and, again, makes you lose your bet?
Yeah. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, Tom Bevin and I have a couple bottles of wine on a bet, and it seemed to me like taking candy from a baby. All I had to
do. You were dancing in the end zone.
Yes.
Okay? Spiking the ball like three weeks ago.
I wouldn't spike a bottle of wine, but yeah. But all I need is an infrastructure bill of any kind to win the bet. You'd think these clowns could pull that off in Washington, but not yet. Joe Manchin is looking, he's been looking at the price tag for this, and the Democrats want to pass a bill on money that is either A, borrowed, or B, comes from new taxes for an infrastructure. And now the progressives are arguing that that infrastructure has to include provisions that punish, not to put too fine a point on it, but punish coal states, where Joe Manchin represents the number one coal state. So, yeah, they could push too far and they could lose this. They could lose this bill. That's what's happened. But silver lining here, because that wine that Tom bought for me will be good in October as well as September. There's nothing good wine. Fine wine ages well, doesn't it, Tom? There's nothing magical.
I told you, I'm getting you Boone's Farm. It doesn't matter when I buy it. It could be.
There's nothing magical about September 26th, other than the Democrats gave that date.
Sean was shaking his head vigorously while you were talking, Carl. So,
oh, I was shaking my head at the idea that this thing isn't going to pass. I mean, I think so. Back in 2009, 2010, Jay Cost was at Real Clear Politics, and he and I. I had a 2-hour commute at the time, long story, but he and I used to sit in the car and we would count the Democrats, and we could never get up to 217 votes for Obamacare or 218. Like, it was just like, no, you have the STUPAC Democrats. Remember, like, the anti-abortion people who just weren't going to vote for it with the current provision. You had people like Feingold who said he wasn't going to pass vote for it unless there was a government-run healthcare plan, the public option, as they called it. You just had all these factions, and like, we had trouble getting to like 205. But as we wrapped up our conversation, we always said, "But you know what? The president usually gets his big ticket agenda item through, because this is why, at the end of the day, these people have D's after their names. They're Democrats, and they want to get things done." It was the same thing. I mean, you know, that was my take ultimately on Obamacare repeal, which actually they did have the votes for. It's just John McCain screwed them, told them he was going to vote to repeal. So they let Collins go, and then he shows up at the last vote and does thumbs down. So from a like floor management vote counting perspective, they had those votes at the end of the day for all the hemming and hawing. And I think it's the same thing with this infrastructure bill. Like, everyone is staking out positions. Everyone understands, though, at the end of the day, something has to get done. Now, the caveat for this is that there is an outside chance that, you know, you only need like the squad plus Cori Bush to go Freedom Caucus and just be like, no, like $6 trillion, $3.5 trillion is our compromise, like put their foot down. You know, with those small margins, you could see something like that happening. But I would give long odds that they will get an infrastructure bill and a substantial reconciliation package through.
You think they're going to get both? And when you say substantial, what do you define substantial?
$1.5 trillion or more.
So that's the Manchin number.
Or more.
1.5.
Call it two. Or more. Call it two.
You think they're both getting through?
Yeah.
Wow. Tom, what do you think?
I've said this before. I mean, it sort of defies logic, and that the Democrats would not take the win on the hard infrastructure bill. They've got 19 Republicans in the Senate. Just pass it. It's $1.2 trillion. I mean, that's a no-brainer. But they have they have wrapped themselves into this conundrum by tying these two bills together and basically doing this high wire act, which could very well, you know, I don't know what the odds are. Maybe it's 10%. Maybe it's closer to, you know, 40 or something, that this whole thing crashes and burns. Because as Sean said, it doesn't take that many people either in the House or the Senate, right, to scuttle this whole thing. And they do seem to be having trouble getting to a number on the budget reconciliation. And they're, you know, they're jamming in all this climate stuff and immigration. I mean, Chuck Schumer's at war with the Senate parliamentarian trying to, you know, I mean, it's messy. It's very messy. And so, and the more you try and stuff in, I think the more opportunities there are for things to go wrong and bad and alienate, you know, a person or two or five or whatever. So, I mean, just for the sake of my bet, I hope it doesn't happen, because there's nothing I want more than Carl Cannon buying me wine. However, I would also probably say it wouldn't surprise me if Nancy Pelosi caved in the end and they put the infrastructure bill through and then went to vote on the budget reconciliation bill and couldn't get the votes for it for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But it may well be, as Sean says, that they both pass and they'll have to come down and it'll be a number that's, you know, $1.5 trillion, and the progressive wing of the caucus is just going to have to just sit there and take it.
Well, Carl, you know, there's one other aspect which and Tom mentioned this. The Senate parliamentarian has a vote in this as well, because she may say that this energy part of it is really a regulatory effort and doesn't belong in a budget bill, and shoot it down. The reason they wanted the reconciliation bill is because then it only takes 51 votes to pass it, and they don't think they could get this kind of environmental stuff done if they had to get to 60 votes in the Senate. I don't know. I'm feeling your bets. I think Tom may win this thing. What do you think?
you can have in on that action anytime. I can see Sean Trendy is.
I've got a side bet for you, Andy.
Agrees with okay. me. Wait a minute. And just for the record, we're not talking about Boone's Farm. We're talking about Chateau Montelena. So just, let's get that on the record, too.
I will just say, at the end of the day, the Stupak Democrats folded like a cheap suit. At the end of the day, they were like, this is the bill.
That was a long time ago. Like,
yeah, sure. I'm going with it. They'll fold.
You know what? Sean pointed out correctly that Terry McAuliffe doesn't remind anybody of Cray Deeds, the forgotten Democrat who lost to Bob McDonald. Well, Bart Stupak, he didn't have the passion of AOC, who has described the $1.2 trillion package as a tiny, pathetic, bipartisan bill.
I was just going to say my side bet is if push comes to shove, Chuck Schumer will just replace the Senate parliamentarian to get what he wants.
That's happened before.
Yeah. Look, I will say my one caveat. The one time I thought, okay, this thing might actually fall apart was when the squad, I think it might have been AOC, one of the squad members accused the infrastructure bill of being racist because there are no people of color on it. And I think AOC actually called Manchin a racist. So that was the one time I was like, ooh, this might actually, and I'm sure they knew what they were doing. So that's like where my 5% comes from, is that you have some people who are further out on the left than even Feingold was back in 2020, and the margins are so small, they might decide to tank it.
Well, we're going to leave it there for today. I just want to say one of the reasons we keep focusing on infrastructure bill and this bill is, well, there's two reasons really that I'm still interested in.
Because you love it.
I love it. Well, because I think that, and I think Carl agrees with me on this, that if you can't get infrastructure passed, what the heck do we have government for? But the second thing is, given what's going on with the Biden administration and the polls, if they lose on this, that's a real setback for an administration that's had a terrible summer. So a lot depends on this. September 27th is the date that Nancy Pelosi has said there'll be a vote. So that's coming up. So tune in early and often. We're going to keep following it here at Real Clear. So I want to thank Sean Trendy, Tom Bevan, Carl Cannon. We're usually here Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays in some form or fashion. So bookmark this podcast. Check back often. As always, I encourage you to go to Real Clear Politics. Read one article from a writer or a publication with whom you disagree. Football is back. It means you have all that time between plays to get into political arguments with your family. So be armed, but play fair. And if you haven't already, you should subscribe to Carl Cannon's Morning Note. It's a free newsletter. Comes in your inbox every morning. You can sign up for it at realclearpolitics.com. I don't start my day without it. You shouldn't either. Thank you for listening. Until next time, for Real Clear Politics, I'm Andrew Walworth.